#1 internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to LATalkRadio.com, Channel 2, for those who are paying attention. We are live every weekday morning at 9 o'clock. It is Thursday, June 13th. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, Linda O'Brien, for the voice work. She's a dear girlfriend of mine out of Dallas, Texas, and she does voice work professionally, and it's such an honor and a privilege to hear her say our intro every morning, because I feel like I get to give her a big hug every time I hear her voice. Also, you can hear the podcasts every day, downloadable, on demand, on iTunes, into your Android or your iPhone at MariaSanchezShow.com and TheMariaSanchezShow.com. We're going to get into the top news stories of the day. We also have on the program a foodie. She's going to talk with us about totally local, from farm to table dinners that you can use wherever you are, no matter where you're listening, that she's going to give us hints on how to make it happen in that regard and what are their constraints. I call it from farm to fork. And then later on in the program, we have an internationally acclaimed flamenco artist, dancer, and singer who's appearing locally, but you can catch her internationally as well. She's going to be visiting with us. Last night was Wednesday, obviously, and my sons come for dinner every Wednesday, and last night was their turn to make the dinner, and they are whirling dervishes. They hit the door. In fact, I try and have the meal ready as soon as they get through the door, because they basically starve themselves during the day so that they can avail themselves of the calories that I provide for them. They're very health and weight conscious. Two out of the three are in exquisite physical form. The third one is getting there. And so I always try to cut corners in terms of calories and making it healthy and as nutritious as possible. And they're like, no, go ahead and make it the way you want to, because we've accommodated for that. So that also means that their blood sugar is plummeting. There's not really a lot of opportunity for pleasantries and chit-chat before we get to the meal. But yesterday, since they did the shopping and then they come and do the cooking, they were fast and furious. They made, it was 80-20 meat with ground, I think it was just the meatballs, that they put in an entire head of garlic and breadcrumbs. Then they pan fry that in my Spanish olive oil. And if you want to know about Spanish and Italian olive oil, that's a whole other topic. We'll get into it some other time. And then turkey, Italian sausages. And then they make their marinara. They use Classico. I always use puree and diced and chopped and paste and saute. And then they caramelized onions. And then they wanted to know how I was going to eat, because normally I eat my pasta. I don't eat pasta. I eat spaghetti squash. I said, or spinach. So they brought spinach. And that probably sounds funny to you, but I've just put fresh raw spinach rinsed in the bottom of my bowl with the marinara on top, which helps it to wilt, and then the sausages and the meatballs. So that took them, 45 to 50 minutes to make that as they're fast and furious in the kitchen. We sit down to eat. And then every single pot, pan, and bowl that I have in my kitchen was used. So the sink was overflowing with dishes, and my contribution is when they shop and cook, then I do the dishes and vice versa. So I said to them, before we watch Arrested Development, which is the series that they're turning me on to, we're in season two now, and not the new ones, from the former one, I want to do the dishes because I don't want that looming in front of me. So literally every pot and pan, three big cauldrons were used because they made different kinds of pasta, because one son, who's exceedingly fit, wants the high-fiber whole wheat one, which I used to do, but since they didn't like it, I don't do it anymore. So we had this whole thing, and then we go outside because the weather had been warm and it turned nice and breezy, And we're chattering, and finally it's like, oh, gosh, I don't know, 7-ish or 7:30. And they're like, well, okay, it's time to watch an episode. And I said, and I had a gentleman caller coming over after they left, and he had been out of town for a week, so it was, I wanted to catch up with him too. And it was like, but I don't want to rush my time with my sons, so I just figured I'm going to go with the flow, which we did. So we watched one episode, and I said, if you guys want to leave, we can watch three next week. No, let's watch another one. I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, okay. So fortunately, he's very understanding about my time with my sons. And so we watched the second episode of whatever we're into of the season, and then they pack up and go, and my Mr. Wonderful comes over. So I had a fabulous evening, and it was wonderful to be able to be with family and then to be with Mr. Wonderful. All right, news this morning, the Supreme Court has weighed in on one of the four major decisions that we've been waiting for, and this one is on genetic testing. Can products of nature, like isolated parts of the human genome, be held as the exclusive intellectual property of individuals and company through government-issued patents? So unanimously, the Supreme Court, which I love it when they're unanimous, because then we don't have dissenting opinions and no acrimony and all that. They said that natural human genes cannot be patented by companies, but synthetically genetic material can. And this coming out of Utah, which is the company that has the BRCA1 and BRCA2 testing that is very expensive because they're the only ones that do it. Apparently that's good news for them because their price just went up this morning on Wall Street in trading. So the whistleblower Edward Snowden has done a interview for the first time with the South China Morning Post, that is since he met with the Guardian, the UK Guardian. And he was working for the defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, excuse me, at the National Security Agency, in there, and he exposed that the PRISM program, which gives officials easy access to the data held by 9 of the world's top internet companies. His quote that they're sharing with us this morning is, "My intention is to ask the courts and people of Hong Kong to decide my fate. I have been given no reason to doubt your system. There is no extradition request filed as of yet." And what's interesting, they did, Reuters Ipsos did a poll that they released late yesterday. They polled Americans on Tuesday and Wednesday. Roughly 1 in 3 of us say that the former security contractor who leaked the details is a patriot and should not be prosecuted. 23% of those surveyed said that he's a traitor, and another 46% said they didn't know. And his quote is, "I'm neither traitor nor hero, I'm an American." So what's interesting about this Reuters Ipsos poll is that the 35% of those surveyed said that he should not face charges, while 25% said he should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Snowden told the South China Post that he intends to stay in Hong Kong. By the way, and this was news to me, a petition that has been started on the White House website to pardon Snowden, which was posted on Sunday by a reader, has about 70,000 signatures on it. And why this might be of note is the White House reviews and responds to any petition that gathers more than 100,000 signatures. So finally, some 45% of those surveyed say the program is acceptable under some circumstances, that being the NSA surveillance program, while 37% say it is completely unacceptable. And it came out at the dinner conversation with my sons last night. So I know when it's hit their radar, it's big news. Also in great news category, the 10-year-old Pennsylvania girl with cystic fibrosis that was near dying, she was in a medically induced coma since over the weekend, did get a double lung transplant yesterday and is doing well. The 6-hour procedure began at 11 a.m. local time. She's in Pennsylvania at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The statement from her mama is, "Her doctors are very pleased with both her progress during the procedure and her prognosis for recovery." So as you may know, that the family sued the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from enforcing a policy that prevented children under the age of 12 from getting adult lung transplants, even if they are extremely ill. A U.S. district judge granted the family a 10-day temporary restraining order on June 15th, and under the wire, there it came. We have contacted the National Center for Organ Donors, and they're going to be a guest on our program to talk about what and how you can be a donor and what the rules and regulations are. I've never wanted to be a donor because I was worried. I'm one of those that want to be connected to life support as if there's even a pinky finger of hope that I might get recovered. I've heard too many stories where it's happened. In fact, I know a woman personally that was in a coma for 20 months, and her four children were trying to get legal so they could pull the plug, and she came alive like in the last 6 weeks, and she is perfectly normal, except for she's not ambulatory because the poor thing, they didn't do physical therapy on her while she was in the coma like they should have, but that's something that she's going to be able to reclaim. However, now that there's this in the news, I'm thinking, you know what, I'm going to sign up to be an organ donor. I'm donating blood later this morning in that regard, and we're going to talk to somebody about that too next week, about why blood donations are so important and what they do and where they go, and also what benefit they are to the donor. So it's like a win-win in that regard. But now we're going to be speaking with Kat Merrick. She is the founder of Totally Local VC. And again, this is a story. Hi, Kat. You're on the air with Maria Sanchez. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you for being available to chat with us, because I'm just sharing with our listeners, regardless of where you live, what you have done with Totally Local VC is translatable to any kind of community. So that's what's cool about your story, is that it's local, but it's also relatable.
Yes, it's absolutely true, and that's the goal, is that we start translating this live local and support local all across the nation.
So what was the genesis for you to do and found Totally Local VC? Why did you see the need?
It's actually kind of funny. My kids will tell you that my soapbox is pretty worn out, that I've always kind of preached this conversation. But what I saw, I had been in the apparel industry for a very long time, so my background was really kind of studying trending, you know, when you do design and work like that. So you're watching trends, and I saw this trend coming and a need for it, actually, is more so. The economy was crashing. People are all trying to figure out what to do, how they can, you know, survive. And what really translated to me, I realized, was, you know, that if we had strong cities, if we were supporting from within, each individual city can almost become economically sustainable. What happened was, with this globalization, we start, you know, Our dollars are spread on a national level, on a worldwide level. But if you kind of contain it a little tighter in your own communities, you can survive, and you can build a stronger economy. And the towns that have done that, the villages that have done that, seem to be a bit stronger when the hard times hit.
So you're suggesting that if we buy local, that then we're supporting the folks that actually brought that product to the shelf in order for us to purchase it?
Well, the biggest thing is we say is when you look at buying local, you buy local, you support your local small businesses. Those are those local small independent businesses. More dollars circulate in your community, they stay in your community, they don't leave. So they keep regenerating and regenerating. And one of the statistics and the studies that have been done show that if you shift 10% in your shopping to a local independent small business, you can generate about $138 million just back to the Ventura area. So you think about that, and those dollars keep going and going. But what we ask, so people, you know, we kind of make it realistically, we ask people to shift 10% of their spending. And in doing that 10%, we find that people, they start getting into it, and they start getting educated, and they start kind of saying, wow, this is kind of fun. Wow, and it is cost effective, and it's all coming back to our community. So we find that people tend to shift about 60 to 70%, but we understand that you can't get everything local, so that's why we ask for 10%, and then we encourage people to think this way. Local first, local small independent, regional second, and then state, country, you know, U.S. made, basically. And if you're doing all those things, you're helping build a small city. Small and economically strong cities build a strong state, which build a strong country.
So regardless of wherever somebody, if they're in Poughkeepsie or if they're in Duluth or whatever, what do you describe as local? Are you talking zip code, area code, mileage?
Well, we go by what Totally Local VC did. When I started analyzing all the other Shop Local programs, and I looked at farmers markets, and farmers markets are the ones that have done a lot of the kind of guidelines, and so I kind of culled from that. And what we did is we came up with the same guideline of 50 to 100 miles. So for Totally Local VC, we say within 100 miles of where you live. And we understand that sometimes when you're supporting a local small business, it doesn't necessarily mean all the products in there are local. We'd love it to be, but we can't get everything locally. So at least if you're shopping at a small, independent, locally owned business, those dollars are still circulating. And then we try to work with our business owners, our restaurants, our business owners, and try to encourage them to do as much local sourcing as they're able to as well.
So how did you get the word out that Totally Local VC, and in other words, is your Totally Local VC is all about just creating awareness about local?
So it's a couple of things, and this is what I realized too when I looked at other programs, is that we didn't want to become just this flat print type, you know, stick a poster in the window and tell everyone to shop local. So what we did, the development of this program kind of just became like, three-dimensional, it's interactive. So what we do is we say we educate. So we spend a lot of time through our social media site, our website, writing articles. I go out and I do a lot of speaking engagements. I'm on radio shows like Your Wonderful Show and telling people the reasons why we should do this and trying to help educate. Then we say we do advocacy. And so we work a lot with our cities. We work with our farmers. We try to help as much as we can, link together to try, you know, sometimes it's just, I don't know who to talk to try to solve this problem. So trying to link everyone together to have this open conversation of how we can make it easier for our small businesses and help our small businesses. And then we also say we celebrate, which is all of the events that we do, our Totally Local VC dinner series, our kids' education programs, our farm tours that we do, our music series, music is business too, art series that we do. We do quite a bit that is interactive with our community.
So give us an example about, if folks are listening and they want to, you're inspiring them, which is why I love this story, is that, again, it's local, but it's relatable regardless of where somebody might be. Explain what a dinner series is like.
Oh, our dinner series, it's one of the favorite things that I do because it just, and I'll explain when we get to the end of it. What we do is each year we host a three-part dinner series. Each of the dinners are set in different iconic locations in the county of Ventura. It's a farm-to-plate dinner, which every single thing throughout the evening, from your tasting of the wines at the start of the evening, the appetizers, you're tasting a local brewery that's actually right here in Ventura Brewing, and then all through the meal, every single aspect is local. You basically are eat, drink, smelling, tasting, and hearing. And then every single dinner at the end, we turn around and relate it back how this area or the location relates back to farming. So each one has some kind of story to tell, and farming usually is the one that built that, which built a lot of our towns and our communities across the nation, you know. So.
And where do you have the dinners? Are they in restaurants or are they homes?
No, they are outdoors. Every single dinner is outdoors. We've had dinners in the middle of a pumpkin patch, in the middle of an orchard on top of a hill, in the sand at the beach. This year, our dinners start at a botanical gardens here in Ventura. There's a beautiful park that we're going to be in that overlooks all of Ventura County. It's got 360-degree views, and we'll be sitting high up atop the hill kind of enjoying that, and that one's on June 27th. The second dinner is going to be right on the front lawn of Ventura's City Hall. It's the 100th year anniversary of the City Hall building. The building was designed by a world-famous architect who came up, who also did Grauman's Chinese Theater, which most people know that when you say it. Also the Los Angeles Courthouse, he was world-renowned. So we're going to be celebrating the 100th year anniversary, and the tie back to that is that farming built that beautiful building, our City Hall. And then the final dinner rounds up at a ranch here in Ventura County, again with 360-degree views, kind of enjoying and hearing about the ranching aspect of Ventura County.
Now, who's invited to the dinners?
Oh, it's open to the general public, so anybody that wants to come and attend, they can go to totallylocalvc.com, look up events, and purchase a ticket and come to the dinner. It's a really cool, eclectic group of people. So it makes it's a fun evening. Everybody sits. It's one long table, so it's a king's table, we call it. And everyone sits in, at this one long table. They're encouraged to sit with people they don't know, because that's what it's all about, is getting to know your community and the people that surround you. The meal is served family style, so everyone has to kind of serve each other and have conversation going. And we find that when people sit down and eat a meal together, you kind of bond, and it opens the door for a lot of great conversation.
And how do you determine what is going to be served?
Well, we have three. We have a different chef for each dinner. Each chef is paired with a local winery and a local beer maker, which is our local surf brewery this year. And the chefs are, I have them constantly. I'm in the field walking with them, looking at what's in season right now. There's a constant phone conversation. I love it. Rachel Main, the chef for our first dinner, calls me and says, you know, I was calling Phil McGrath over at McGrath Family Farms, and I love it. He was on his cell phone driving his tractor telling me what's in season for the dinner. You know, and I'm like, that rocks. That just rocks, and I just love it. So, we do a lot, and then sometimes we'll even drag our wineries and say, come on, get out in the field with us, you know. I had Chef Tim Kilcoyne at one point, you know, he's got basil and all this stuff sticking out of his pocket talking to the winemaker of Vino V Wines, and it's funny, they're tasting all this stuff he had stuffed in his pocket from the farmer and talking about wine creation. And I finally just stepped out and said, I just want to sit here and listen to two of you. This is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it's sexy too. I mean, you know, it's and it's visceral, and I mean, it's philanthropic, if you will, and it's paying it forward. I mean, it's got so much goodness in it. So how many folks do you anticipate usually attend, and what's the price range?
We average anywhere from 135 people up to 200.
Wow.
We usually cap it at 200. Yeah, it's a lot of people. The tickets run $135 each, and they benefit a charity. Every single thing that Totally Local VC does comes back to our community. So this year's charity of choice is Future Farmers of America and the Steve Tobe Scholarship Fund for Ventura County Culinary Students. We felt that we needed to be very ag-centric in how we give back. All of these kids somehow in their life will be putting their hands on food, either growing it or hopefully cooking it up for us, and that's what we need, more farmers, more chefs, and more very food-conscious youth coming up in this world to say, we need to eat better, we need to eat local, we need to eat in season.
So you get 100 to 200 people paying $135 for a meal?
Well, yeah, and you know, when someone says that, like you just said it, I love to reply that you start the evening and you've got wine tasting, beer tasting from our local limoncello company. There's past appetizers. You either get a walk and talk. You get to go into places sometimes you never get to go. Like at City Hall, there'll be a tour kind of behind the scenes. And there's always some aspect like that. You sit down and you have a five-course meal with dessert, wine, beer, and no tipping. You already tipped because that check you wrote goes to a charity. I don't think you could go out for an evening like that and spend that amount. You'd probably spend a lot more.
Now, Kat Merrick is our guest and the creator of TotallyLocalVC.com. How long have you been in existence?
Oh, 3 years. We're going into almost about 3.5 years right now. We're pretty excited about that.
And what has the reaction been like from, because I know Ventura, if folks aren't familiar with the community, you guys are over 100,000 with your population, so you're not small in terms of the county of Ventura.
I
lived there for 1 year, and it was my first urban experience in my life, and I was just amazed about how fiercely independent you are in general, if I make a gross generalization.
You're not. It's Ventura County is a ferociously tight-knit group. I think even when you go into each of the cities, the pride that we have, I think it stems out of that. We have so much. I mean, you think about the growing in Ventura County, just let's talk ag a second. There's five Mediterranean regions in the world, and that means they can grow about five crops a year. Ventura County is the only one in the United States that can do that. The rest are all obviously in the Mediterranean area. So you look at that, and we've got stuff like raspberries growing, you know, at sea level near sand, where they're usually an alpine region type crop. So you've got, you know, that just blows my mind what's coming out of our earth here. And the soil is some of the best in the world. And We look at that. Then Ventura County, again, you look at me and go, wow, there's this huge hub of these artists that have kind of flocked here, too. So we've got artists, musicians. You've got cool downtowns. You've got the mountains. You've got the ocean. It's kind of like we've got it all.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very proud of their community.
And what's interesting,
and I think that helps.
And being sandwiched in between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara County, Ventura used to kind of be this blip that you just traveled through in order to get to one of those places or the other.
Well, people come here. I talked to a man the other day, and he said, you know, he had moved here from Austin 3 months ago. And he said, I came here because this is what Austin was like 20 years ago, except you guys have the beach and mountains, and you got a lot of other cool stuff. And, you know, and when I go along all up and down California, I kind of marvel at the fact that we've been able to just stay this quaint, cool little town, Ventura. Mm-hmm. You know, Fillmore's done the same. Santa Paula's been able to just keep that magic that they have as well, while other cities are just kind of wiping out farmland and building strip malls and all this kind of stuff. There's a few communities in this area that have been able to kind of maintain that feel of originality and uniqueness, so we all don't look like, I call it one place, the same place, because they all look the same.
Kat, I know you've got pretty strong opinions about the big box stores. Share with us why you feel the way why you feel the way you do about them.
Well, there's a couple of different things that kind of go on. When you get into too much of that, it just becomes like, I'm trying to think of the nice way to put it. They start kind of controlling. Again, coming out of the apparel industry, we learned very quickly. When you get into some of these big heavy hitters, some of the biggest, which their names don't need to be mentioned, they start controlling your factories and your production lines. They start dictating to them, and they start controlling pricing. They start driving out the little guys, and that's not cool. They move into a town, and some of these big boxes, Walmart in particular, I will say that one, they come in, and there's been studies that have been done that poverty levels rise and more need for food banks, and food rises. And you've got to look at that. And they come in and they lower their prices, and the minute that they drive out their competition, which is usually our small businesses, they jack their prices up. So, and I don't think people realize it, because you get sticker blindness. You think, oh, it's a great deal, and then you stop watching those prices. Another thing I think that's important, it's a better conversation than talking negatively about the big guys, is to just say this. In every single economic downturn that we've had in this country, it's been small, independent, local businesses that have brought us out. And during the Great Depression, California was the leader in bringing us out of that, because we were at that time one of the biggest innovative states in the country. So between ag and small businesses and invention. So I look at small business and I go, man, they're a lifeline.
So you've
got to protect them.
And your message is powerful, but it's also doable. And I'm really curious, because years ago when I used to interview folks about organic, they had the same mantra then that you have now. If you take just 10% and you buy organic, you're going to help not only your health, but you're going to help the organic industry. So you're saying if you just take 10% of your purchases and buy local, that's 50 to 100 miles, that is more than doable. And
It's a realistic approach. You know, you have groups out there that are 100% and you can't, and I go, no, that's just not reality. It's just not reality. And in this day of consumerism, we've got to be realistic so that people feel comfortable with it. And then once they learn it, they tend to shift almost 50 to 60 in cities that they're able to do that, you know. And it has to be something that people go, I can do that.
Well, because what some people might not think about is that it's not just the vendors, the brick and mortars, that is benefiting. The city does because of the sales tax.
Oh, yeah. City has more sales tax coming to them. And you know what I say is, like, you think about that $138 million by shifting just that 10% in our area. And I tell people, okay, then I go inside of a restaurant and I sit down and I look at their menu and I circle everything they can get local, and I help them link that connection together. Or I go into small businesses and I say, how local are you from within? Because if you want me to support you local, let's take a look at it.
Mm.
Let's see what you can do to shift. Mm. Are you using local web service guys? Are you using a local accountant? There's a lot of things. Even if their product necessarily can't be created locally, there's a lot of shifts that they can make to keep their dollars from within their businesses locally as well.
Kat, how are you funded?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
How are you funded?
Oh, man, it's all from love of God. It is all, it's sponsorship. We have a lot of great sponsors that have stepped up and supported this. Our small local independent businesses can join. It's only $240 for the year, and they get to be on our online directory. We post about them. We write articles about them. They're included in every single event that we do, and then we start working hard to create those links with those small businesses because there's a lot of linkages there that they can do to other small businesses, whether it be ag, again, accountant services. I was talking to the city of Ventura the other day, like, hey, man, we've got a little office supply store in Oxnard, California that delivers, and their prices are just as good as the big guys you guys have been buying from. And this is local, and that's tax dollars staying in our county. So any way we can.
I think it's just awesome. You're inspirational. You're practical. You're reasonable. You're obviously talented. You're articulate. Congratulations, Kat. Fabulous.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And speaking of linking, when we post this podcast later today, I'll be linking to you. So
awesome. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's totallylocalvc.com for anybody that wants to pencil that down and get a ticket, come to the dinner.
Yeah,
enjoy.
That too. So did you want to share the other dates? Because you shared June 27th, but you didn't share the city
hall.
Oh, I didn't.
So June 27th is the dinner at the garden, which is the botanical garden. That's featuring Chef Rachel Main, main course, wine from Kantara Cellars, Surf Brewery, Beacon Coffee. Dinner at the city is July 18th, and that's the one celebrating the 100th year of our city hall. If you haven't seen it, look it up online. It's an amazing, amazing building. Chef Tim Kilcoyne, the Wines of Four Bricks Winery, Surf Brewery, and Beacon Coffee. And then finally, we wrap up at Dinner at the Ranch. That's a private location, so we're not revealing that till we get close. That's October 10th. And again, we have the wines of Old Creek Ranch and Vino V. We've got Chef Jason Collis, Surf Brewery, and our wonderful Beacon Coffee. Desserts for this are going to be by Allie's Avocado Pies. The next one is going to be from Sticky Fingers, and then Jen's Baked Goods. And every single thing is so original. Again, all local ingredients, and it's an amazing evening.
You know, it's funny, at least 20 years ago, probably 25 years ago, I was living in Northern California and was guests of this couple that lived in San Francisco, had us to dinner at a dinner party, and everything on the table was local. And they, at that time, talk about cutting edge. Of course, San Francisco is a little ahead of us in a lot of things. But it's taken this long for it to get, you know, for you to be able to share it. And I just can't congratulate you enough, Kat. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we really appreciate the support. It comes in daily, and it's because of people like you that help us spread the word. So we really appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Kat. Take care. Have a great rest of
your day.
Bye-bye.
You too. Thank you.
So that's a perfect example of a story that's local, but that's relatable. So if you don't live in the area, that's okay. If you want to make a difference in your community, as she says, a strong city creates a strong region, which creates a strong state, which creates a strong country. And it's about us. Every dollar that we spend makes a difference. I have a personal adage is one voice, one vote, one paycheck. What you do, where you align yourself, where you spend your money. I even think about that when I need to put gas in my car. I deliberately do it in my community so that that revenue stays there. And my kids go through phases where they say, it doesn't really matter. Like, you know, it's just one vote. It's just $1. I'm like, no, it all adds up. Look at the story that we shared about Edward Snowden and a petition that is on the White House website. It doesn't have enough signatures yet, but if it gets to 100,000 signatures, then the White House will pay attention and will respond. So it does matter. It really does matter. So great, Kat Merrick, that's awesome. So, and we will post her contact information later today as we do. Before we get to our next guest, a few more news stories. Yesterday, Jason Leffler, a NASCAR veteran, has died in a violent crash on a dirt track in New Jersey. So he driving a sprint car, and they usually run on dirt or paved oval tracks. He was on the fourth turn of the preliminary heat when his car left the banked dirt track, flipped several times down the down the front straightaway, and he had to be pulled from the vehicle. May he rest in peace and his family. Apparently he's got a five-year-old, and that's just such a shame. Google announced earlier this week that it had acquired Israeli mapping service Waze. Unlike Google Maps, Waze has created a culture of user engagement because Waze generates many of its maps by using GPS to track the movements of its nearly 50 million users. A third of Waze users share information about slowdowns, speed traps, and road closures, allowing Waze to update suggested routes in real time. And its most dedicated fans can also edit the maps to directly improve their accuracy. So a graphic designer here in the United States in Omaha made 280,000 changes to Waze maps in the last year. And he says this created a culture where you can really help others. So Google may be buying Waze to spread this culture of user engagement. They're apparently going to allow the CEO and most of its people to stay in Israel and operate independently for 3 years, and then we'll see what they do after that. Finally, a story in the news today. It's been a year that the study went on. The newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times, and the Center for Investigative Reporting has released the results of their studying, and they did about nonprofits. So it's a really long report, and it's a really long study, and as you may know, I'm a huge fan of the American Red Cross. There are all kinds of charities that exist because there are so many needs that they answer. However, this study talked about the nation's 50 worst charities, and the reason that they're worst is because that the smallest percentage of what they raise goes to actually what they say they do. The 50 worst charities paid professional for-profit companies to raise money for them. They paid them nearly $1 billion over the past 10 years. And until today, no one had tallied the cost of this segment of the nonprofit industry. So if you can get your hands on the study, if you do care and donate and volunteer for charities so that you can see where yours ranked, after I read this, I went to one of my favorite sites. It's called Charity Navigator. It's supposedly a nonprofit that ranks other nonprofits. When I was offered the position with the American Red Cross as Director of Development and Communications, I went to them first to see where they stand. They're in the top five in general all the time. And the Charity Navigator gives you all different kinds of ways that you can rank the charities. But I always pay attention to what percentage of the donated dollar actually goes to services, meaning, when you donate, are you really donating to the cause, or are you donating to somebody's salary or to their overhead or to the cost of doing business? And so that's what I pay attention to. So we've got Maria Bermudez joining us next. She is an internationally acclaimed flamenco dancer, artist. She's raised here in Southern California, and she's made it big. She's got a couple of things and performances that we're going to help promote, and she's joining us this morning.
Hello.
Maria, this is Maria Sanchez. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Good
morning. And yes, good morning, Maria.
Thank you for your time this morning. And we're going to go a little bit into your background and then specifically into the events that you are tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday in.
Okay.
So people, and then also, how in the world did you come to study flamenco and to be a performer of it?
Yes. Flamenco came to me by way of my elder brother. His name was Alfonso Bermudez. And of course, I'm talking like maybe he started in the 70s, more or less. He was a folklorico dancer, Mexican folklorico, and then he did some Aztec dancing. And when he saw the first show that came through town, which was a flamenco show in one of the festivals here locally in Los Angeles, he was smitten. He got bit by the flamenco bug, and he decided to make flamenco his career. So he went on to go to Spain and to learn flamenco there. And a few years later, unfortunately, my brother succumbed to an illness, and he left us like at a very young age. He was 29 years old.
Oh my, I'm sorry.
Yes, at the very, very beginning of his career, he was making a stride for himself, a very nice name for himself in that community. But here we are. In the meantime, I was listening to flamenco. I grew up with it in the background because of his work, and I grew up hearing flamenco in my household. And you know, when he left us, something mysterious happened that I all of a sudden wanted to dance flamenco. In the meantime, I was doing theater. I was studying theater because he was like 7 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
So, while he was doing his flamenco, I was still in school, but I was interested in the arts, but in theater. I was also a singer. But it wasn't until he left us that I got bit by the flamenco bug, or as some are led to believe, that his spirit maybe mm-hmm. came into me because mm-hmm. he wanted to continue dancing.
How poetic.
Now, yes.
Can you, and let's, Maria, mm-hmm. let's go back just a wee bit. How would you describe flamenco to our listeners who are aware of the word but not of the art?
Well, this flamenco is many describe it as a folkloric art form because it does come from the gypsies of Spain. But it's become a very universal art form. Now it's included in many, many different kinds of genres. You know, there's many fusions that anywhere from, you know, people like Alicia Keys or Eric Clapton, they've all included flamenco in a lot of their musical projects. So it's become very universal. But flamenco is of the heart. We analyze it as being like the blues of America.
But is it predominantly dancing is what we're speaking of?
No. See, that's where everybody, yes, it's predominantly dancing as we know it because it's the most popular. But the basis of flamenco comes from the singing, the blues.
Okay.
Because anytime, you have a repressed culture, there's always the arts that gives us that relief. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That relief and that release
mm-hmm.
of whatever kind of suffering or whatever kind of injustices may be, lived by those people, then the arts are there to relieve that. And so that's how flamenco was born, through the cries of the blues.
I would say
of their blues.
Plaintive yep. wails, almost.
Yes.
So
exactly.
When you decided to study it, what and how did you do that?
Well, yes. When I decided that I wanted to make flamenco my career, I was pretty demanding on myself, and I decided I wanted to go to the source. And that meant going to Spain, mm-hmm. because that's where it originates. And I wanted to take it a bit further than what my brother was able to do in his short life. He was able to go to the capital, you know, to the big city and learn it there and work with companies like with major flamenco dance companies. But I knew there was more to flamenco than just the dance, just like we're talking about now. The idea is that it's the baile, but I wanted to know more about the roots. So I went deep south. I went to the deep south of Spain, Andalusia, and I found out that that's where the first cry was heard of flamenco and by the gypsies. And that's where the flamenco originates. So I've spent a little over 20 years.
Wow.
Living in that area and really doing my due diligence of learning the art form. And so that's where I've been all these years. And that's where my fountain of inspiration is. And that's where I create my work. And then I come here and I tour and I bring my companies from there. And we tour all over the world, actually. Yeah.
So you are having a production here in Los Angeles on Saturday, Forever Flamenco, At the Ford Theater.
Yes, the Forever Flamenco at the Ford on this Saturday. This Saturday is a very special event, and it's very unique. This time around, I'm not bringing my full company from Spain. There's a few representatives from Spain from our company, from Sonidos Gitanos is the name of my company from Spain, and there's a few representing. But this is an unusual event in that our godmother of flamenco here, her name is Deborah Lawler, and she's been one of the main producers here of flamenco in Los Angeles area, and we are giving homage to her and recognition for all the years since 1990, I believe. She's been producing flamenco in Los Angeles and all the artists nationally of the U.S. and internationally, meaning my companies from Spain. And so we're paying homage to her on Saturday evening, and we're rounding up a whole slew of artists from U.S., from Canada, from, and from Spain.
For this one night?
Yes, one night only.
Wow.
And it's almost sold out. I mean, there's still some tickets left, but we're almost there. And it's also a very significant fundraiser also for the Fountain Theater, because Deborah also runs the Fountain Theater, a 99-seat theater, Equity Waiver House in East Hollywood. And it's also a very successful venue where there's the most serious and popular theater productions that happen there, and flamenco. This is where the Forever Flamenco shows happen once a month, on a Sunday.
And is that still the case?
What's that?
Is that
I'm sorry?
Still the case that she still has productions once a month of flamenco?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
So,
it's an ongoing. Yeah, she's been doing that for 20 years, I think it is now. Yep.
So if people can't, like, I have a conflict for Saturday, so I won't be
right.
able to be there, which I'm bummed at. But we can see a mini iteration of it once a month.
Absolutely. They really are great about presenting. Very beautiful standard, high standard artists that are either passing through from Spain or on tour, or even our local talent, because we have a lot of really great local talent here in Los Angeles. And so once a month on Sunday, you can see some of this talent at the Fountain Theater.
Now,
in East Hollywood.
Before we run out of time, since you're so diverse and multidimensional, you have
yes.
two more nights in the production of Heart Song. Even though it yes. does run through the end of July, your contract with them expires tomorrow night.
Yes, it does.
Tell me about Heart Song. What?
Heart Song is another very unique production because the Deborah Lawler's artistic director, producing artistic director partner at the Fountain Theater is a very eloquent and sensitive writer and director also. He wrote a play called Heart Song, and it has to do with flamenco, but also has to do with women who need, relationships with their mothers, and who pursue finding their own personal cry, and in this case, flamenco is the way to her heart song, to finding her own cry and releasing all that suffering and all the stuff that we tend to repress in our daily lives. And one of her best friends takes her to a flamenco class, and then that's where the story begins. We get to see the main character, Rochelle. We get to see her journey come about and find her true cry and her release and her resolve with the relationship of her mother, who had passed away 1 year ago.
So there is acting and dancing?
There's major beautiful acting, beautiful, beautiful actresses that are just supreme talents. And then there's flamenco. There's also flamenco music, and there's flamenco dancing. So it's quite a very unusual, it's one of a kind, actually. It's a one of a kind play. It's, and I'm talking, and I live in Spain, so even relative to Spain, it's unique.
And what theater is that at, Maria?
Say that again, I'm sorry?
What song is where? Where is it? The theater.
Yes, the Fountain Theater.
Oh, it's at the Fountain also. Okay.
Yeah, it's at the Fountain.
Okay.
And our very intimate little theater there. And it's, like I say, it's running through the end of July.
Excellent.
Unless it gets extended. It just might get extended because it's having a lot of success.
Excellent. Well, Maria,
yes.
I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for taking the time.
So did I. Thank you so much, Maria, for having me on your show. And yes, I look forward to meeting you in person.
Me too. Me too.
Okay.
And continued success.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing your talent here also in Southern California. Maria Bermudez, we will put all that information on our website. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Hope you have a great day. Looking forward to visiting with you tomorrow morning.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.